The Tom Woods Show, episode 866.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you shavers out there, Harry's wants to send you a free trial set. Razor handle, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. Best shave you ever had, just pay for shipping. Check it out at harrys.com/woods. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm bringing on a guest today I got to know thanks to our old friend Gene Epstein over at Barron's. And he told me I really needed to read this book called The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet by Nina Teicholz. So I did, and I found it very, very interesting. Now, this book was a massive bestseller, New York Times bestseller. The Economist named it the number one science book of 2014. It was also named a 2014 best book by sources as diverse as the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, Mother Jones, and Library Journal. Before writing The Big Fat Surprise, Nina was a reporter for National Public Radio and also contributed to many publications, including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The New Yorker, and The Economist. You can check out her website at thebigfatsurprise.com. Nina, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here, Tom.
I just got done telling people about your book. I love it. I'm very interested in it. I don't know how I could possibly not have been aware of its existence. I try to be reasonably well-informed. This thing was a big deal. It was a bombshell. Somehow I missed it. I don't know what to say other than I won't let it happen again. But I've really enjoyed looking through it. I have some interesting questions for you that maybe you haven't been asked before. But let's start with one that you have been asked, no doubt, which is, if the thesis of your book is true, which, by the way, I'd like you to lay out in two sentences, how did we ever get on a path that was so wrong?
So the thesis of my book is that the idea that fat, including saturated fats, which is the kind of fat found mainly in animal foods, and cholesterol are bad for you and cause heart disease, that hypothesis was always based on weak science, has since been thoroughly disproven. And so the whole basis of our nutrition policy in this country has been a mistake, and that this has been going on for 50 years, that America has been subjected to this diet that has made us fat and sick and has been based on bad science. So how did this happen? Well, that's really the incredible story of my book, which my favorite description of it is as a nutrition thriller, which is what The Economist called it. But, you know, it's an amazing story of science, how science is, in this field at least, more political than scientific, how crusading scientists who wanted their idea to be right basically got it implanted into the American Heart Association, the National Institutes of Health, our whole government got behind it, based on extremely weak science. And then, you know, the short story is it got completely institutionalized, and now we are having a mighty difficult time backing out of it.
All right. So there's a lot in there. Let me just ask you quickly about, you know, the time period when this science begins to, let's say, ossify, the early 1960s, particularly after Eisenhower, I guess, had a heart attack and heart health was very much in the news. You talked about some of the research that is said to have gone into drawing these conclusions, and some, at least some portion of it, involved evidence drawn from people who inhabited the island of Crete. And I found this particularly interesting because the evidence there, the way it was drawn, seemed to be rather oblivious to some major, I don't want to steal your thunder here, but tell me the whole Crete story.
Well, the Crete story really ties into, you know, if there's a villain in this story, it's a scientist named Ansel Keys, who was a pathologist at the University of Minnesota. And really, it was his idea, which was called the diet heart hypothesis, that saturated fat and cholesterol are bad for health. He came up with this idea in the 1950s. And as you say, the whole nation was riveted on the question of what causes heart attacks, because President Eisenhower himself had a heart attack, was out of the Oval Office for 10 days, just imagine, in 1955. And, you know, it was a relatively new disease. People's grandfathers hadn't had it, and everyone wanted to know what caused heart disease. So Ansel Keys came up with this idea, and then he set out to prove it. He was basically convinced by his idea before he had any evidence. And one of the things his major study trying to prove it was called the Seven Countries Study, this famous study where he, and one of the things he did, one of the places he visited was the island of Crete, where he, this is in the late 1950s, and, you know, it's post-World War II, Greece has been devastated. People are not eating the diet that they normally eat because they're poor and their country has been ravaged by war. And he sampled the diets of only 30 to 33 men. And they became his star subjects. He decided that they ate very little animal, very few animal foods, and they had very low rates of heart disease. They seemed to be very long lived. And sort of based on them and one or two other populations, he kind of concluded his theory was right. Well, I took a deep dive into this study, you know, in addition, one of the things I did for my book is I refused to rely on any kind of summary papers or review papers. I had to go back and look at all the original data myself, because one of the things I uncovered in my research is there's so much basically, you know, lying that's gone on about the data or misrepresentation of it. So I discovered that not only did these people not eat any saturated fat, they didn't eat any sugar, zero sugar. So, you know, sugar is now considered a major contender for what is promoting heart disease. And Keys knew this was a possibility, but he ignored it. The other thing is that he went and visited this population three times. One of the times he showed up was during Lent, Greek Orthodox Lent. Do you know what you're avoiding during Lent? All animal food. You know, it's a strict Orthodox Lent. And so he drastically undercounted the amount of saturated fats they ate, meaning he may have gotten a completely wrong picture about their diet.
That's just astonishing to me that you could make a mistake like that. Or I mean, I guess he acknowledged it, but didn't think that it really skewed the results much.
He did what he did with all the data that didn't agree with his idea, which is he just dismissed it. He'd just say, well, we know this happened, but it's not important. So, you know, one of the things that I went back is I showed just how important it was. I went back to find what was Greek Orthodox Lent like in the late 1950s, you know. They didn't just avoid meat. They avoided all dairy. They avoided fish. I mean, they really, it was a very strict fast. So this is what Ansel Keys did with his science. He also, for that study, really cherry-picked the countries that he visited. He visited countries that he knew would fit his hypothesis, and he avoided places like, you know, France, the French paradox, right? But it's not just France. Germany, Switzerland, they all eat a lot of saturated fats, and back then had, you know, very equally low rates of heart disease as in Greece and Italy. So, but he didn't go to those countries because they would have blown his study.
But this, I get this story. And yet it's hard to account for how the conventional wisdom that was thus produced persists over time. Surely somebody is going to blow the whistle on this instead of everybody going along with it. In fact, in the TEDx talk that I watched of yours just this morning, you were saying that by the time you get to the mid-1980s, the dissenters have been completely marginalized, and the new orthodoxy is everywhere. You can't get published if you're a dissenter. This is not how my middle school textbook taught me science proceeds. I learned that Francis Bacon taught us in the 16th century that you gather data, and you then examine the data, and you come up with hypotheses about it. You test the hypothesis, and it's all very dispassionate. And yet, I sound like somebody from Mars describing science compared to how this was carried out. How and why would that be?
You know, I had the exact same impressions of science when I started in on this research about 15 years ago. What I realized was it's mayhem out there in the world, nutrition science. One of the things that goes on, which was astonishing to me and continues today, actually, is just flat out bullying in nutrition science, where Ansel Keys and his colleagues, right? So it's not just him, it's his whole body, his whole colleague, his group of colleagues, they come to control the most powerful institutions, the American Heart Association, which was really the first one in the game, and the National Institutes of Health, which was very and still is very closely allied with the American Heart Association on this issue. And so they controlled all the bodies, and they all came from elite East Coast universities. And they just controlled the agenda. And anyone who had a counter theory to theirs or who critiqued their theory, saying, There's a case of a Texas A&M professor who critiqued their theory, saying, you know, I don't think the evidence holds up. They would pounce so hard on those scientists, you know, dozens of pages of rebuttal and accusing their work of being full of errors and literally accusing them of lying. There's in quite a few instances that I documented, these professors who had gone up against the orthodoxy literally just got out of the field because they felt it was so unrewarding or they couldn't get any money to do research. There's a story that I tell of one of the most prominent critics of Ansel Keys, who was one of the directors, a prominent scientist, a biochemist from the University of Vanderbilt, who had been one of the directors of a famous study called the Framingham Study. And he opposed Ansel Keys. And he was at the National Institutes of Health one day, and the secretary calls him out into the hall and said, you know, if you continue your opposition to Ansel Keys, I'm afraid to tell you, you're going to lose your research grant. And shortly thereafter, he did. So this is the way that nutrition science has proceeded. And I have to add again, the way it still proceeds today. I mean, the stories that I could tell you about what's happening today are similarly shocking.
Well, but I think now it's easy to understand how a lot of people would be skeptical of the scientific consensus in other areas, because they may well say, Nina has come across some really important information here in nutrition science, but there's no reason to think that human pettiness is confined to nutrition science, and that maybe the way science operates is really by a means whereby the conventional wisdom becomes accepted by everybody. If you want to get government grants, you better be adopting the conventional wisdom. You'll be shut out. You'll be ridiculed as an idiot. You're anti-science, you're anti-evidence, and your career will be destroyed and you'll live marginalized. That doesn't sound all that unusual to me. I hear that all the time.
Yes, sadly, I think it is true. And I think it's especially true when the federal government gets involved in doing the science and having a stake in the science. So the federal government got involved. Not only the National Institutes of Health funded all the research in this area, and they adopted the hypothesis that, you know, saturated fat, cholesterol cause heart disease. But they also then starting in 1980, they started implementing the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, which is this huge, it's the most important nutrition policy in the country. It affects everything and everything everybody eats. And not only that, but it drives all of the feeding assistant programs like school lunches, feeding programs for the elderly, the military rations. Okay, so now those feed 1 in 4 Americans each month. So now you have a huge interest by all food companies and grain and soy and, you know, all these different industries that have an interest in influencing the dietary guidelines, because their contracts, all their food contracts for all these programs depend upon, you know, if the government's recommending, as they did in this last go around in 2015, the dietary guidelines said they increased the amount of vegetable oil they recommend daily from 24 grams to 27 grams. Well, that means a lot to the vegetable oil companies who get those contracts. So the whole thing becomes entrenched, or captured is another way of putting it for people who follow government.
Well, having said that stuff about science, let's ask some questions dealing more with the substance of your claims, because it seems like at least every couple of years, I read headlines about some new study telling you shouldn't eat red meat, right? We hear this all the time, you shouldn't eat red meat. Now, I wonder if there's any way in these studies, I don't know any of the details, I don't know the methodology used, but is there any way to correct for the possibility that a lot of people who eat a lot of red meat would tend to be people who in general ignore the experts' health advice? So they just have unhealthy lifestyles in general. They're ignoring people who say don't eat red meat, but they're also ignoring people who say don't sit on the couch all day, don't do these other unhealthy things. So in other words, you're dealing with people who are just plain unhealthy, and this may skew the results.
That is absolutely true. And that's a kind of bias that one attempts to correct for in these studies, but And you're talking about a kind of study called an epidemiological study that can only show association. It can't establish cause and effect. And that's a very weak kind of study, precisely because there's all this kind of confounding. People, who's eating red meat? You know, other than the paleo folks, it's really, you know, mainly people who completely ignore everything their doctor tells them. So So of course they're less healthy in a myriad of ways that you can never measure or correct for. And I think that is, in fact, what we're seeing in those red meat associations. And even then, the associations are absolutely tiny. They're so small. They're below, their numbers are below what would ever be considered acceptable if it were a drug trial. It would just be considered, it's just, you know, it's so small as to be just noise. So, but there is a kind of, I think, in the this scientific community, there's sort of an anti-meat bias and a pro-plant-based bias that has come about for a whole number of reasons. And there's a reliance on this weak science to make policy, which is really not what is supposed to happen. You're supposed to rely on a more rigorous kind of evidence called randomized controlled clinical trials where you can actually show cause and effect. And those really haven't been done on red meat, which is surprising given how much we hear about how red meat is bad for us, that the actual evidence base is remarkably thin. I mean, tiny. And there have been no randomized controlled clinical trials on the vegetarian diet. So even though we're told, you know, we're pretty much continually told that that's the most healthy diet. So that those recommendations don't actually reflect the actual base of evidence out there.
But, you know, every time I do an episode, which is not often, but every time I do an episode that calls for or in some way advocates a diet that would be similar to Mark Sisson's Primal Blueprint, I do get a lot of vegetarians and vegans vigorously and briskly protesting in the comments section. And boy, they sure seem to be pretty well read.
They have as a database those epidemiological studies only. They really don't. There aren't any clinical trials, randomized controlled clinical trials to support their beliefs. There was one by Dean Ornish on, you know, 20 men. Actually, the outcome of that was that they had two deaths in the group that was on his diet and one death on the other group that was not on his diet. So, yeah, I think there's a number of reasons to be vegan or vegetarian, and they are all many reasons that are legitimate. But if you're doing that diet for health, you just have to know that the actual rigorous evidence base for that diet to show that it's healthy and can prevent disease is almost really non-existent.
All right, let's pause to thank our sponsor. I drive my family crazy and have fun doing it, by the way, by telling them that the store brand is just as good as the name brand. And they're telling me, get out of town. Come on, we all know the store brand stinks. Now, they admit that for things like salt, it doesn't really matter what the brand is. But they say, for things that matter, you gotta get the real brand. Well, I think that is a good general principle. For things that matter, you gotta look out for quality. For example, sleeping, you gotta have a good mattress. But also, your shave. You do that every day. There's a potential you could be making yourself into a bloody mess. And it conveys a look to people. It makes you look either professional or hopeless. It makes you comfortable or miserable and stingy. So you got to get the best. What's the best? Harry's. I have been using Harry's razors with tremendous results. Vastly better than blades I've used in the past. I gave up on blades. Wouldn't even use them anymore. Smooth, close, comfortable, beautiful. And yet, you won't pay outrageous prices for it. And in fact, they're going to give you a free trial set for nothing. Just pay a tiny shipping fee, and they're going to send you the razor handle of your choice, 5-blade cartridge, and shaving gel. It's free when you sign up. That's how confident Harry's is in the quality of their blades. Want to redeem this free trial offer? Go to harrys.com/woods. For a long time, I think everybody was under the impression that fat, as you know, fat's a bad thing. You got to avoid fat. So therefore, you got to eat these meals that leave you hungry, and it's just miserable and awful. The diet regimen a lot of people wound up on as a result. But then people started saying, well, there's good fat and there's bad fat. So for instance, if you're eating olives or an avocado, you shouldn't reproach yourself that you're eating fat. These are good fats. In fact, as a kid, I didn't know any better. Like when I was 10 years old, or maybe not 10, but 15, and I would look at a can of olives and there was so much fat in them, I thought, I guess I shouldn't be. What an idiot. I wasn't eating olives because of this sort of advice. So we got this bifurcation of good fat and bad fat. What do you think? Is there any bad fat?
You know, I just want to say that I sympathize because I used to be a very low-fat vegetarian for nearly 20 years. So I know better. I poached all my fish because I couldn't stand the thought of putting even a little olive oil on my fish. So Well, the story is really upside down from what we've been told. And I know it seems almost impossible to believe. You know, it really did take me a decade of research and reading all the studies to kind of come to the conclusion that I did. But that, first of all, fat is not bad for health. Fat is actually what fills you up and satiates you. So more fat in the diet, diets that are higher in fat, consistently make it easier for people to lose and maintain weight, because that fat is just satiating in a way that, you know, carbohydrate-based foods like bread and pasta and popcorn, they're not satiating, and people tend to overeat on those foods. So good fats and bad fats, I would say that it's almost completely turned upside down. I mean, vegetable oils, which is the what we're supposed to have margarine instead of butter and replace whatever we can with polyunsaturated vegetable oils, you know, those are an industrial product that go through, you know, like 24 steps, including like solvent with chemical solvents used to prepare them. They are not a natural product and really only came into the food supply, first in the form of Crisco in 1911, but, you know, and their rise in the food supply, which has been astronomical. I mean, we greater than any other food over the 20th century has been the increase in vegetable oils. It perfectly paralleled the rise in heart disease for the first 30 years. So there's a plausible case to be made that vegetable oils might even be the cause of that. But I think that, you know, they tend to be highly unstable. They contain trans fats, or they did, and they tend to oxidize and cause inflammation. That's, I think, one of the scariest parts of my book when I discovered, like, actually when they took trans fats out of vegetable oils, what they got were far less stable oils that oxidize more rapidly and cause massive inflammation. Massive inflammation being one of the chief contenders for what causes heart disease. So I would say that although we're told to eat polyunsaturated vegetable oils, really the evidence does not support it. And that better fats are solid, stable fats that do not oxidize. So paradoxically, that's better. Even lard. Lard is what your grandparents used to cook with before they switched to Crisco. Or tallow. I mean, butter and lard have been the chief cooking fats really since ancient times. So it's a different story than what we've been told, but I think it's truly supported by the evidence. And there is a really growing movement now all over the world. Scientists are really reexamining the data on fats, and amazingly, and nobody's really heard of this, again, due to this political nature of nutrition science and what actually gets out there. Groups of scientists all over the world have reevaluated the data on saturated fats and found really they do not cause heart disease, and they're not associated with cardiovascular disease, or they don't cause it. So we should, those fats, you know, my argument is just let them out of jail. I mean, they're parts of many whole and healthy foods. Dairy, meat, eggs used to be the centerpiece of all diets for all human cultures. And they're healthy and they contain a lot of nutrients, so we shouldn't avoid them.
You know, you were saying about how you hesitated to put butter on things, and it reminds me of the years and years I went not putting butter on my pancakes, thinking, well, at least I'm not putting butter on them, so I can congratulate myself for that. But it turns out the butter is better than the pancakes, I now know. It would have been better to eat the butter than the pancakes. And, you know, I told you before we went on, I've had Mark Sisson on the show, I've had Rob Wolf on the show before, and for a while I did follow their, Mark, the Sisson version that allows dairy. I followed that for a while, and I kind of fell off it because one of the promises they made didn't come true, which was after a while you won't even miss pasta and pancakes and whatever. And I guess I must have liked those things a lot more than those people did, because I was missing them like crazy. But at least I'm informed, and I'm trying to make reasonable decisions about my diet. But just to, I'm sorry if this sounds like a dumb guy question, but I really just want to nail this down. What would be the reason that I shouldn't sit around eating? What's wrong with eating a big bag of potato chips then?
Well, so first of all, if they've been fried in vegetable oils, there's the problem that fried vegetable oils cause inflammation. So that's one thing. And, you know, by the way, when they measure potato chips, they always just assume it's just the potato and not the vegetable oils that is having this effect. But the potatoes are carbohydrates, right? So here's what the literature shows. If you are somebody who has a metabolic condition, which means you are, and they all come from the same source, you're struggling from obesity or diabetes or heart disease, Increasingly, Alzheimer's is seen also to be the same pathways that lead to all these diseases. That means that you have developed an intolerance of carbohydrates. Your body is no longer able to process them. Your body can't produce the insulin it needs, or you have too much insulin circulating all the time because you've eaten too many carbohydrates. Because like me growing up, you know, I was eating like Captain Crunch cereal with chocolate milk, you know, that was what I thought, you know, I was fine. Who cared? But over time, chronically eating those foods all the time leads to kind of your body gets a kind of form of exhaustion and can't respond to it anymore, can't produce the insulin or insulin's not effective that responds to carbohydrates. If you're one of those people, what the literature overwhelmingly shows is that instead of counting calories, which is relatively ineffective, you need to count your carbs and reducing total carbs, not only sugar, you know, or some people can just cut out desserts and that's it. They lose 30 pounds. But the best results are seen in terms of actually even reversing diabetes, people getting off their medication and losing weight sustainably. You have to reduce your total carbs. So some people have to go really low. Other people can go moderately low. Other people can have a bag of potato chips once a week. I mean, there's people who cycle through carbs, but you overall have to reduce them so you're not chronically exposed to them all the time.
So the long and the short of it is this low-fat, high-carb diet that has been championed for many years, and frankly, you know, I'm not trying to politicize this, but was championed from the White House by the First Lady with school lunches that are leaving the kids starving, but they're low fat, so they're supposed to be good. Like, this is still 1964 or something. Like, look, there's been no advance in knowledge since then. But it's not just her. I don't have to single her out. I'm pretty sure the U.S. government is still telling people that the old food pyramid is by and large correct, and the base is, you know, 7 to 11 servings of grain per day. And this has been going on for more than 50 years. Certainly there are some dissident scientists who are coming forward, but, you know, the USDA and whatever nutritional agencies we have seem still to be acting as if nothing has changed. Or am I missing something?
No, what's extraordinary is that they really do not acknowledge that their diet has been a complete failure. If you look at rates of obesity in America, they're fairly low throughout the 1960s and 70s. 1980, the dietary guidelines start, and there is a sharp uptick in rates of obesity. So, you know, the evidence is really gaining that it's the dietary guidelines that made Americans fat and diabetic. If you have 6 to 11 servings of grains a day, your grains in your body, that turns into sugar. So that's really almost guaranteed to make you fat and eventually diabetic. So yeah, the last go around of the dietary guidelines, I was the only person quoted saying, we need to have change because the definition of insanity is just doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. You know, the dietary guidelines are unchanged from when they started, which is a high grain, high carbohydrate diet. And, you know, why is the government not backing out of that or not reversing course? You know, there's questions of flip-flopping on your public. There's a lot of interest who are lined up behind this particular diet. I mean, my hope is that there might be change under this administration, but, you know, it's very hard to change policies once they've become deeply entrenched, is my understanding.
Well, that is the frustrating thing about all this, especially given the abundance of the evidence. And by the way, have you run into the objection that while you're a journalist, you're not really entitled to an opinion, you should shut up and leave this to the experts?
Oh, yes, I have received that.
Oh, well, how about that?
Frequently. Well, I have a couple of answers to it. One is, the main one is that you're right. You should have a PhD making these arguments to you. But in fact, all the PhDs are who were making these arguments have been drummed out of the field.
Right. And
if you come up in, you know, being taught what they're taught in nutrition schools, you would have no idea that this line of thinking exists because all of your teachers are, you know, teaching the conventional wisdom. Critics had to come from outside the nutrition field in order. You know, the main critics are, the first one was Gary Taubes, who's a science writer, and you know, his books were kind of the big bang of this whole field, and mine has been, you know, the book that really penetrated into the mainstream. And so I think there's no way for a critic to come up on the inside in this field.
And what's interesting and perhaps heartening to bear in mind is that the scientific revolution, one of the most momentous periods of Western civilization, consisted of people operating outside the existing university system. That did not develop out of the existing universities. It was everybody working on the outside. So you are part of an honorable lineage of people working in the vineyards tirelessly and eventually coming up with very, very important stuff. Well, the book is The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Nina, I appreciate your time. Great conversation. And I'm sorry I was a little late to the party, but better late than never.
Well, it's great to be on your show and just a pleasure talking to you. So thank you.
All right, everybody, before I dismiss you, I would like to do a little favor for a friend, James Newcomb, whom I have gotten to know over the years, both as a libertarian and as an entrepreneur, and he's been a guest on this show, and I just want to make you aware, I'm not being paid for this or anything, but he's a good guy, and I want to make you aware of something. He's a great musician, and he has just produced a little course called Secrets of the Musical Mind. He says it's a 10-lesson course geared for musicians or anyone who faces any type of performance anxiety to understand the relationship between the brain and music, what causes stage fright, how to overcome stage fright, and lots of practical guidance for performers to achieve peak performance. So you can find out about it at secretsofthemusicalmind.com, and I will link to that also on today's show notes page, which is where you should get Nina's book, by the way. That's tomwoods.com/866. If you are enjoying the show, consider joining the elite as a supporting listener over at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.